So, Nia, the Mac buzz, it happens.
Judith Butler is the Maxine Elliott Chair Professor at the Rhetoric and Comparative Literature Departments at the University of California, Berkeley. She has previously taught at Wesleyan and Johns Hopkins Universities. Butler has made significant contributions to the fields of feminism, queer theory, political philosophy, and ethics, and is considered to be one of the most influential intellectuals in the world. To coincide with her visit to Barcelona to take part in the seminar, Body, Memory and Representation, Sunia talked to Judith Butler about politics, economy, control society, gender and identity.
My name is Judith Butler. I'm an author who writes on feminist theory and philosophy and social and political criticism. At the age of 14, I started studying philosophy, and I began by studying Jewish philosophy. And then when I went to college, I studied existentialism and European philosophy. And I went to Germany and I studied Hegel and Marx and the German idealist tradition. And I wrote a dissertation on Hegel's phenomenology. And then only in the middle of the dissertation, I was working with feminist movements. And someone said, oh, why don't you write on feminism? I don't write on feminism. I'm just an activist, but my serious work is all philosophy. But then I started to write on Simone de Beauvoir and Monique Wittig and some French feminist traditions. And then I wrote Gender Trouble, which was my first serious work in feminist studies, but that I didn't write that until I was, at least 30 years old. I feel like there are left intellectuals in Barcelona, and that people want to be part of a social movement, that very often their thinking is bound up with the problem of social and political transformation. I think sometimes in the United States I have a stronger sense that people in the academy are isolated from the broader social and political struggles, but at least more recently in Europe, certainly in Greece and in Spain, I've experienced, and to a certain extent in Germany, I've experienced intellectual life that is bound up with basic questions of power and of war and of inequality, and sees itself as part of a broader social and political movement. I think that's extremely important for me.
Neoliberalism and the wicked virtue of sacrifice.
One thing I think we're seeing right now as neoliberal economic changes take over the markets and the educational systems and the healthcare systems throughout Europe is the sense that the people are supposed to sacrifice because the financial times are very hard, right? So we get a new emphasis on the virtue of sacrifice, the virtue of charity, the virtue of working at a low age or giving up part of your pension or your retirement benefits, waiting to get a permanent job, right? As if your personal sacrifice is necessary in order to keep the economy going. And of course, this happens at the same time that we see extraordinary profits being made by major corporations, especially global corporations, who are acting in concert with states that are very often involved in the waging of war and the making of money off of war industries. So it's a good time to be an anti-capitalist. And I have to say, although that's not been the focus of my work, I'm feeling more passionate about this matter all the time.
Financial market anxieties.
I know that as we speak, there are many decisions being made about the status of the financial markets in Greece, in Italy, and in Spain, in Portugal. And it is true that something called the financial market seems to have a kind of power over the life of the people. And we see that it's not actually part of any conception of democracy, really, if you think about it, since most of the working people and the poor people, or people who are going in and out of temporary labor don't feel represented by the markets. They're not invested in the markets in any direct way, and yet they are made to feel that the markets have a certain control over their lives and their future happiness. So the discourse about the market produces an enormous anxiety. It also makes most workers feel their complete lack of control over their own financial future, right? So on the one hand, we're made to feel frightened. On the other hand, we're made to feel powerless.
Contemporary surveillance.
In a way, contemporary surveillance power works in the same way. We go to the airports or we try to cross a border. There's all this security and it communicates anxiety. Something terrible might happen. We need to search you. We need to ask you questions. We need to look at all of your material. We need to bar you from the country, or we need to suspend your entrance into the country. And these kinds of intimidation tactics also shore up a sense of an urgent power, right? An urgent power that we have to respect for the purposes of our security, at the same time that these very powers make us feel extremely powerless, extremely frightened, and extremely anxious. So both in the financial markets and in the new security regimes, we get the production of anxiety and powerlessness at the same time.
Social networking, new possibilities of global connectedness.
I was impressed how important Twitter and social networking was in the revolution in Egypt. And also it's been very important in getting news out from Tehran, especially what happens in those demonstrations and what the police violence has been. So I am very interested in that because I think it produces new possibilities of global connectedness that are very important and which make it more difficult for violent or tyrannical regimes to keep their power. I mean, I'm not a utopian in the sense that I understand that Facebook is itself a corporation and it's making a lot of money, apparently. At the same time, I don't think it can control its content completely, although we do have to consider how censorship works within social networking at the same time that we must consider how it sometimes works to counter the forces of censorship.
A performative identity.
I think that it's very possible to feel that one is already made by some other force, right? That I came into the world belonging to this religion or belonging to this race or belonging to this nationality or even belonging to this gender, and that I have nothing to do with it, right? That I am passively constructed by powers that are larger than me and that were operating before I came into the world and which operated on me. So I am nothing but a kind of passive vehicle or recipient. And I think it's true that we are formed very profoundly by certain kinds of cultural influences. I mean, even here in Catalonia, you know, one sees the language, the culture, the history. It's very, very important to how people understand themselves and who they are in the world. And yet, it seems to me that the history of a culture, the history of a nation, of a race, of a gender, it does change over time. And so the real question is, how do we account for innovation, even in those cases where it seems like we're just made, we're just determined, we're just constructed by something stronger than us? And sometimes it feels like moving through mud, right? It's very hard to make any movement whatsoever. It's very hard to clear any new path. It's very hard to... You can't throw off your formation. But, you know, we're not just formed once. We're formed, and then we keep being formed. And at some point, we also form ourselves in the midst of being formed. And so this possibility for innovation, for experimentation within these legacies, within these traditions, within these formations, I guess that's what I would call performativity.
Symptoms, a kind of protest.
I think there are modes of protest that are not necessarily spoken and that are not necessarily fully conscious. And we could say that sometimes when the body falls ill, or the body has trouble moving, or the body is frozen in its posture, that some kind of protest is being articulated by the body at the same time that it's being checked or stopped, right? So you have a symptom is interesting in this way, because if you think about hysterical symptoms, the body is in protest, it protests, but it stops its protest at the same time. So those are forms of impasse that take bodily form. People can suddenly not be able to speak. or they speak too much and they can't stop. Or suddenly their arm is not working. It always worked before. Why isn't the arm working? Insomnia can be a kind of protest, right? Or a kind of fear, as can sleeping too much, refusal of the world. So I think there are also anxieties that people have about what they take into their body. No food like that. I don't want to be around smokers. I don't want to travel on buses. I'll get bacteria. You know. And very often those kinds of moments articulate social anxieties. Do we have control over our space? What is it we're afraid of catching from someone else? And I think that it's especially hard, for instance, for transgendered people to have to pass as a gender that they don't feel that they are. And very often there are kinds of compromises that are made at the level of the body, or experiences of bodily pain that one has that don't get relieved until one can make a certain kind of transition into another gender or begin to live in an open, embodied way, in a different way. But I think with symptoms in particular, we have to find the moment of protest and the moment of censorship and try to unlink the two. Because sometimes it is true, we become our own worst censors. We censor ourselves. And of course, external power works most effectively when it's unnecessary, because the subject is subjugating itself. So then the symptom might be understood, bodily symptoms can sometimes be understood as a mode of self-subjugation.
The communication of the law.
If we think about the church, or the Catholic Church in particular, and I'm thinking about how it works in Italy, for instance, it works through intense visual iconography of Christ and Mary, but also sermons, very strong proclamations by the Pope or by the bishops, very often edicts and laws that get communicated. What's the relationship between the iconography and the speaking of the law, the writing of the law, the communication of the law? But what about sound? Because the church brings you in with its organ and with its music, and you become part of a community, and that music brings you together. So at the same time that you're receiving instruction on what you should and should not do with your body, what marriage is, what sexuality is, what the proper role of men and women are, right? You're having intense visual experience and an intense auditory experience. I think we have to reduce the police function of gender, right? I mean, it's terrible that children are made to feel, oh, you have to do your gender in the traditional way, otherwise you will be punished. Or you have to conform to certain gender norms if you want to have friends, or if you want to be accepted, or if you don't want to be shamed in public. So very often that's communicated to children, and they grow up with a sense of fear. Am I being a girl in the way that I'm supposed to be? Am I being a boy in the way that I'm supposed to be? Someone teased me for how I look, or how I sound, or the way I sing, or what I wear. You know, all these details of everyday life can suddenly become sites of scrutiny and punishment. So basically, I am against all forms of coercion. And so I don't think we can coerce people into new forms of gender. And I don't think they should be coerced into old forms of gender. And I think we should be able to live gender and sexuality in ways that are non-coercive. So that's how I think about it. The real issue, perhaps, is not what do we do with the children or how do we teach the children, but maybe how do the adults come to think about themselves because the real problem is the enormous anxiety and fear that gets communicated by adults to children, right? So rather than teach your child to be a feminist man or something, I think that maybe the parents need to unlearn some of the rules and norms that they take for granted and that they seek to impart.
Makba.cat.